It is very important to most all fishery-dependent communities in this area.
A fish tax fight with the state could affect communities across Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Unalaska's fire chief says he was abruptly forced out of his job.
I basically was given the door, right for Christmas too.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Governor Bill Walker's administration has approved a plan to possibly expand a massive gas field east of Prudhoe Bay. The Point Thompson gas field currently produces a diesel-like fluid, but it's sitting on a giant natural gas reserve that is a crucial part of the state-led gas line project. In a press release, Walker says the Point Thompson field expansion adds momentum to the state's Alaska LNG project, but it has been a struggle to get the field developed. The state's fight with the field's operator, ExxonMobil, stretched out into a years-long legal battle that was settled in 2012. That settlement laid out a legal plan for development. After the field came online last year, Exxon released a plan that included increasing natural gas production and potentially arranging to pipe it to Prudhoe Bay if the state's gas line project had not been approved by 2019. The state rejected that plan in August, saying that the company was not doing enough to prove it would actually expand the field. After months of negotiation, the state released the new plan on December 22nd. It includes more details on what ExxonMobil will do over the next 2 years to expand the field. The company says it will negotiate a commercial agreement to send gas to Prudhoe Bay, some 60 miles away. It will also engineer and design wells and other infrastructure that's needed to expand. The company released a statement saying it wants to develop Point Thompson through a major gas sale. But absent being able to sell it to the state-led LNG mega project, the company is exploring the idea of selling it to Prudhoe Bay instead. Exxon operates the project. BP and ConocoPhillips also have ownership stakes. Alaska State Troopers say police shot and killed a man near a major intersection in Fairbanks on Christmas Eve. The Associated Press reports troopers and Fairbanks police responded to a call reporting a distraught man armed with a gun walking in a residential area in the northern part of the city on Sunday evening. Authorities say the law enforcement officers located the man about an hour later near the intersection of the Steese Highway and Johansson Expressway, about 3 miles from the man's reported location. Troopers say the man brandished a gun at officers, and troopers and city police both fired on the man. He was taken to a hospital where he later died. Authorities have not identified him. Alaska State Troopers say a different man was shot while in the back of a patrol car after he pointed a handgun at a trooper. The man survived and was taken to a hospital in Soldotna on Saturday evening. Authorities say troopers responded to a call reporting a suspicious person walking on private property near the Sterling Highway south of Soldotna. A trooper found the man and offered him a ride due to the cold temperatures. Authorities say once the man was in the back of the car, he pulled out the handgun. The trooper stopped the car and got out safely. Authorities say troopers attempted to negotiate with the man, but he refused to drop the weapon. A trooper then shot the man. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation is investigating. A tax dispute between a single fishing company and the state of Alaska could have far-reaching consequences for fishing towns across the state. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Each year, fleets of factory trawlers and offshore processors catch millions of tons of fish in the North Pacific and Bering Sea. This happens outside the 3-mile limit that marks Alaska waters, but it isn't practical to offload the catch in the open ocean. So it's almost always done in an Alaska port or onto a transport ship anchored in state waters. It's at this point that the state of Alaska takes its cut. The state levies a 3% tax on the value of the catch. It's a landing tax. Half goes to the state coffers, half is shared with local governments.
It is very important to most all fishery-dependent communities in this area.
Frank Kelty is mayor of Unalaska. His city is by far the largest recipient of the landing tax. In Unalaska's case, it's about 15% of the city's revenue.
If this tax went away, it would be a major hit to the community and would have repercussions on a lot of the things we do, but also is the hit to the state of Alaska.
A tax dispute between a Washington state-based catcher processor recently went before an administrative law judge and is the latest effort to dismantle the 24-year-old landing tax. Fisherman's Finest, Inc. operates two catcher processors in Dutch Harbor. In a legal brief obtained by KTOO, it argued that the tax violates at least two provisions of the U.S. Constitution. Company representatives, citing the confidentiality of tax appeals, declined to comment. The Alaska Attorney General's office is defending the tax. It argues that throwing out the landing tax would reopen a giant tax loophole that would allow the Alaska fleet to catch fish in international waters, bring the catch into Alaska, export it abroad, and pay nothing to the state. Legal observers say it's an interesting and important case. Joe Geldhoff is a commercial attorney in Juneau.
Everybody will be looking that's in the fishing business to figure out a way they don't have to pay a landing tax on the fish that is in Alaska. So that's the real fight here, not just the immediate thing that appears to be between this one company and the state of Alaska.
KTOO asked him to review the briefs. He agrees that if the company prevails in the hearing, it would likely be appealed, and that's where it could go from a dispute over a tax bill to a precedent-setting case for the fishing industry.
If a judge, state or federal, finds that the state of Alaska's tax on the fish here is unconstitutional, this will probably open the floodgates for a whole lot of people who say, we don't want to pay the tax either.
It's not clear when the administrative judge will rule. In the meantime, Frank Kelty, the mayor of Unalaska, says he's been on the phone with the city's lawyers and lobbyists.
We're going to be definitely staying on top of this.
The landing tax brought in almost $10 million in fiscal year 2017. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a territorial lawmaker reflects on his tenure and the state's current challenges.
Everything that we have done, we wouldn't think for one minute that we wanted to turn the clock back and try it over again.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Unalaska's fire chief says he was forced to resign on Friday and less than 24 hours later was put on a plane to the lower 48. KUCB's Zoe Sobel has more.
I basically was given the door right for Christmas, too.
That's Arlie Colvin at the airport before his flight. He says resigning wasn't really his choice.
If I did not resign, they were going to not give me one penny, no ticket out of here. I was going to have to be out of my apartment by the 31st, and I didn't have no more than $15 to my name because I'm helping paying for stuff back home.
Colvin believes he was pushed out by Public Safety Director Mike Holman while the interim city manager was out of town. Citing personnel issues, the city of Unalaska is limited in what they can say about Colvin's departure. But in a press release, interim city manager Nancy Peterson said, quote, "We fully understand the need to have solid leadership in the fire division and aggressively recruiting to fill the chief position is our top priority," end quote. On December 19th, Colvin says he was suspended for tardiness, incomplete tasks, and problematic memos. He says all of the allegations have simple explanations. He He was late because of migraines and received limited training on writing the memos. 2 days later, Colvin says he went to a meeting and was suspended again. The next day, he says he was forced to resign.
Yeah, I wasn't even getting a written warning. It was basically told suspended and then terminated.
Colvin says he was told that he was not working out.
And then that I have caused a friction between the police and the fire department. And that is not the case. I was just basically being the mouthpiece of the volunteers and trying to help the volunteers.
Colvin thinks the straw that broke the camel's back was when he prevented the police from turning a room he wanted to use as an office for a new fire chief into a break room.
Fire department has been treated like a stepchild and an afterthought. And you're not going to get another fire chief that's going to work underneath the police chief.
Colvin says he never would have taken the job had he known he would have to work under the head of public safety. He says during his hiring process, former city manager Dave Martinson and current public safety director Mike Holman promised that he would have full control of his budget and operational concerns would run through the city manager. Colvin says he asked for a couple days to pack up and sell his belongings, but the city said no. In a press release, the city says they bought Colvin a ticket for Saturday so that he could spend Christmas with his family in Indiana.
Within 22 hours, I had to give up the cat, so I'm having to lose a family member of mine. Granted, it's not a human, but it's I fell in love with a cat.
A search of available flights shows as of Colvin's departure, there were flights for sale from Unalaska to Anchorage almost every day through the end of the year. Colvin says he had planned on spending the rest of his career, at least 20 years, in Unalaska. And if given the chance, he'd come back in a heartbeat.
I want to come back. I want to be the fire chief here.
But for that to happen, Colvin says he would have to report directly to the city manager, not the head of public safety. Unalaska's Department of Public Safety has struggled to keep a fire chief on staff for the past year and a half. In May 2016, Zach Chasteen resigned from the position. Then in March, the city hired DJ Dunn to fill the role, but terminated his contract before he could start following charges of sexual assault against him in Illinois. Colvin was on the job for 3 months. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
It's the second winter since Bethel opened a liquor store, and the demand on Bethel Search and Rescue to help people who've been drinking has more than doubled since last year. It's a challenge for the all-volunteer organization to keep up. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur tells us how they are looking for more members and hoping that some of the surrounding villages will help.
Bethel Search and Rescue has a mission to find people and bring them home. 40 years ago, when the organization formed, that meant finding people who were lost in the days before cell phones and GPS. As technology changed, so did search methods. But in the last 2 years, another factor has changed and altered what the organization does almost entirely. Alcohol.
We get nightly calls every night for people that are intoxicated. They come to Bethel, they consume alcohol, and they try to return back home.
But they often don't make it. Instead, Search and Rescue gets called. Mike Riley is the group's president.
I don't know if it's called a rescue anymore. What would you call it, Perry?
I think it would be called more of a emergency response.
That's Perry Barr, a long-serving Bethel Search and Rescue member.
Because lives could be lost, and especially with the colder temperatures, we have to respond.
The emergencies involving intoxicated people are increasing. Bethel opened its first liquor store in 2016 following nearly four decades of banned sales. In prior years, searchers would respond to alcohol-related calls about once a month. Last winter, that jumped to about twice a week. This winter, Riley says it's almost every night.
The calls are coming in now from 11 o'clock and then 2 o'clock in the morning. We get up and get ready and get out and do our rescue.
The same five men, including Riley, respond. Bethel Search and Rescue has about 80 active members who will go out on extended searches, like the ones the organization was created for. But the list of names for nightly calls you can count on one hand. Five men with jobs, families, and other responsibilities. Night after night, the calls are wearing down the search and rescue volunteers, and about 20% are for what the group has started calling frequent flyers.
It's really close by villages that they're coming back and forth, and we need more cooperation from.
The organization is appealing to these villages for help. It doesn't have to be all that much.
If they would put something together like a hasty two-man team, that's all you really need.
The increase in night searches is exhausting, even frustrating, but the work must go on.
Where do we draw that line? We can't draw that line on our responses. We get a call, we will respond.
Along with the request to neighboring villages, Bethel Search and Rescue is asking its own members to go out at night. Riley would like to create a rotating schedule, and member Perry Barr would like to see younger people signing up.
Our search and rescue membership is getting long in the tooth, so to speak. They're getting older, and we need some of the younger people in this community to step up and volunteer so that we can train them, spend time with them, they can respond with us.
In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Thinking about completing your college degree? Good news, you can finish it right here at the University of Alaska. Go after your dream by earning a bachelor's, master's, a certificate, or an associate degree at the University of Alaska. Flexible classes, convenient schedules, affordable choices, and outstanding faculty, the university has it all. It's your choice, your dream. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve it at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Alaska's lawmakers will face a multi-billion dollar budget gap and a long list of other problems when they return to Juneau for the start of the regular session on January 16th. But the legislature has faced other seemingly impossible challenges over the years, according to Jack Coghill, who spent decades as a lawmaker in the Territorial House and State Senate. The 92-year-old Nenana Republican visited Fairbanks earlier this month to talk about his life and career and offer some advice to current lawmakers. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Jack Coghill is a bit slowed down these days and a bit bent over, but he's still a giant figure in Alaska history.
Everything that we have done, we wouldn't think for one minute that we wanted to turn the clock back and try it over again.
Coghill was born in Fairbanks and grew up in Nenana, helping run his dad's general store before serving a tour of duty during World War II. A few years later, he won the first of two terms in the Territorial House before being elected as a delegate to the Alaska Constitutional Convention. He's one of the last two surviving delegates, and his is the third signature on the document. Coghill says one of the first disputes delegates had to settle was whether Alaska should remain a territory with a largely itinerant population, or whether, as Jack and the majority believed, it should become a state.
If you read the history of the United States, they didn't want a whole bunch of people sharecropping and all the rest of it. They wanted good, solid citizens.
After statehood, Coghill served three terms in the state Senate before being elected in 1990 as lieutenant governor on the Alaska Independence Party ticket with legendary Governor Wally Hickel. Except for that brief fling with a third party, Coghill was known throughout his political career as Mr. Republican. And because back then, Democrats dominated the legislature, Coghill was always in the minority, which, he says, led him to understand the need to include their views when governing.
I think the most important thing that I did was that I was always making sure that the minority had a chance to say what they had to say. And say, let them talk. Let them do their thing.
Coghill concedes that's still important now that Democrats are in the minority, but, ever the partisan, he hastens to add,
that's where they belong.
Jack's son, John, who followed his dad's footsteps into the legislature and who now represents North Pole in the Senate, says the point is it's okay to disagree politically and have at it during debate. But, John says, his dad believes it's essential to never lose sight of the fact that we're all Alaskans and all want what's best for the state and its people. He cited the example of his dad's long friendship with Bill Egan, the Democrat who served with him in the Territorial House and as the state of Alaska's first governor.
I can remember him and Bill Egan sitting in our living room and having a pretty heated argument over some of the issues they were talking about. When I went out to play, I was just a kid, come back in, and they were laughing and having a good old time.
John Coghill, himself a Republican who's also fought his share of political battles, says that stuck with him.
That showed me that you can disagree with somebody intensely and still be a good friend with them.
Both Jack and John say they hope lawmakers will exercise that sort of collegiality when they head to Juneau 3 weeks from now. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The increasing costs to get into Alaska's fisheries are making it difficult for new fishermen to break into the business, especially in rural coastal communities. That's according to a recent report from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Sea Grant scientists. They worry that in an industry once defined by hard work, a fisherman's success now mainly depends on access to money. KHNS's Barrett Wilbur takes a look at fisheries access and how it could be improved.
In an industry without awards or CEOs, Jim Moore is a PhD-level fisherman. He's been trolling Southeast Alaska since 1971.
Required just a boat and a fishing license only cost me in the neighborhood of $15,000, and today would probably be in the neighborhood of $150,000. And I certainly, as a young person, wouldn't have been able to afford that.
2 years after Jim put his first hooks in the water, Alaska passed the Limited Entry Act. It created a set number of commercial fishing permits. For the first time, your right to catch salmon depended on having a limited entry permit. The state awarded them to people with the strongest fishing record. Moore got one. Others weren't so lucky.
When older fishermen reflect on those years and the ways in which the distribution of those limited entry permits divided families, 8 brothers, one of them got a permit, the others didn't.
That's Courtney Carruthers, professor of fisheries at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
It started to really create long-lasting effects in terms of who had livelihood access, who ended up becoming successful, and who didn't.
As more and more fisheries were limited, this system was praised for professionalizing the fleet, conserving stocks, and making fishing safer. But it inadvertently created a trend that Carruthers calls a paramount problem.
So anyone is able to purchase a limited entry permit. So it sort of benefits those people that have access to capital. And it tends to be that outside fishermen have more access to capital, are wealthier, and buy those permits up.
After 4 years of research in rural fishing towns, her team just published their report. Permits held by people local to their fisheries have declined by 30%. Alaska's coastal communities are losing their rights to fish.
Globally, we're seeing these programs that have, you know, limited and commodified the right to fish have had really big impacts for certain groups of people, young people, low-income fishermen, rural communities, indigenous communities.
In 2004, Lindsay Johnson started deckhanding on a friend's seiner. A decade later, she'd worked across Southeast, Bristol Bay, Prince William Sound, and earned her captain's license. She needed her own operation.
It became clear that the fishing I knew how to do wasn't really in my budget. I could not afford the seine permit. Ultimately, I decided on trolling because I could afford it.
Market value for a Southeast seine permit today is about $230,000. A troll permit costs a sixth of that, $35,000. To afford that, plus the FV Sika, a wood troller, Johnson had to take out a loan. Actually, three.
I have a loan from a friend and the state for the boat and a loan from the state for the permit. It's more debt than I've ever been in my life.
In 1971, Moore needed a boat and a fishing license. But Carruthers' research shows Johnson is a textbook example of what it takes to get into fishing today. With experience, social fishing connections, good credit, practice running a business, and multiple state-sponsored low-interest loans, she made it, at least to the starting line. Without those qualifications, Carruthers sees a generation of would-be fishermen stuck on shore.
Fishing used to be this career that took anybody. There was kind of this option where you didn't necessarily need an education. You didn't necessarily need wealth in your family. There's this opportunity for you to work hard and to be rewarded. And the landscape's totally shifted now.
And as permits leave rural fishing communities, whether they're canceled, sold, or permit holders move away, they take the opportunity for young people to learn the trade with them. In communities where fishing is one of the few options to make money, each permit represents a business that supports families, buys groceries, and pays taxes. Losing one hurts the economic strength of the whole community, Carruthers says.
You see that all through Southeast Alaska, this huge dispossession of fishing rights. Boat harbors, you know, that used to have 30 boats have a couple.
And Alaska's fishing fleet is getting older. The average fisherman is a decade older than in 1975. The typical permit holder is now 50. Jim Moore turned 71 this year.
I've got my grandchildren now that are learning, and I'll be depending more on them to do the heavy lift. But I won't be retiring for at least another 5 years, maybe 30 years. Don't know.
Like Johnson, Moore is lucky. Many fishermen don't see anyone coming up to take their place.
They have to have a rich uncle or some leg up in the system. And I think there's a lot of concern, you know, looking 20 years, 30 years from now, who is it that will be able to access our fisheries?
Carruthers' research includes a suite of policies gleaned from Canada, Norway, Iceland, and the East Coast that have solved the same problems in their fisheries. They range from setting up exclusively local fisheries, reserving fishing rights for young and indigenous people, apprenticeship programs, and more.
What's needed here is some policy shifts, not any changes in terms of what fishermen need to be doing. We really think it's a problem at the level of state and federal policy. There need to be some other options for entry.
The report asks the governor to set up a task force to work on fisheries access. But with Alaska's state budget in crisis, Carruthers worries there's a lack of political will to solve the problem, even with solutions on the table. In Haines, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Barrett Wilbur in Haines. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Get ready to be amazed and get your tickets to this year's presentation of the most outrageous films from the annual Banff Mountain Film Festival and beyond. Radical Reels is at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at 7 p.m. on September 22nd. Bike tough trails, paddle wild waters, ski steep slopes, and hang on to your seats for these jaw-dropping mountain films. Information on tickets and film selection at radicalreels.com. This message sponsored by UAA.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.